Hi everyone, you're listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we look forward to a world in which Singaporeans are proud of our rich and diverse food culture and play an active role in keeping traditions alive. I'm your host, Pamelia Chia, and today I'm joined by Christopher Ng, who is the blogger behind Christopher's Asian Delicacies. Christopher was born in Singapore and later moved to Australia for university and subsequently to the Netherlands for his MBA. He has been active at the Chinese-Indonesian Heritage Center in the Netherlands since 2014, giving presentations and contributing to the Traditions and Culture column. He currently lives in The Hague with his partner and cat, and spends his free time creating exquisite old-school Peranakan confections. So right. What are you doing in the Netherlands?
I came here to be with my partner, and I did my MBA as well. And then I've been working in the corporate environment for until the 2014, when I decided to step out of it. So I've been, staying at home, not working, and doing the things that I like.
Yeah, which is making cakes and kueh and things like that.
I think it has given me enough time to really go into it. And to practice and have the luxury of time, so to speak. Just wanting to perfect it. Yeah. So if you look into my Instagram, it's kind of boring because it's always the same thing.
It's not. I feel that it's wonderful. I mean, hardly anyone cooks like that these days. I mean, the layers are so uniform in your cakes.
Have to thank what you call it, my mentor, like the old lady, the old auntie who taught me. Yeah. You know, hers was really perfect. Her kueh lapis was as if you use a ruler, and you draw lines and they're all straight and even. And so that was my benchmark.
So you're Peranakan in heritage?
No, I'm Hakka.
Oh, you're Hakka.
My parents are Hakka. But we do have Peranakan relatives.
I see.
So it's like a lot of Singaporean, what you call that, families. You live in a multicultural, multi different dialects group. So you kind of, live and absorb, all kinds of things around your family, kind of, so to speak. Mm. Our neighbor of my family home, they were our distant relatives and they were Peranakans. Mm. And it was really very interesting because we were just divided by a fence, so to speak, So during meal times, dishes will just go across the fence, ours will go to them and theirs will come to us, kind of thing. And he married a lady in Wachikata when I was primary three. He married someone who was really interested in baking cakes. Mm. And I actually observed her baking and it's like, I started trying to bake it myself. And I think when I was 9 years old, I made my first orange chiffon cake, so to speak, which was a disaster. But she learned from, at that time, I think it was Lana cakes, it was all the rage of orange chiffon, the chocolate fudge, and it's those things, I grew up with that. Yeah. My grandmother cooked a lot when she stayed with us. And me being me, I think I was quite precocious when I was young, so I was always running around. Up to mischief, and she was taking care of me, and she would just make sure that I am with her in the kitchen. So I saw a lot of things that she made, and kind of learn along the way. And it was really nice, to be with her, in preparing food, because she would have her relatives and her friends coming, and they would. Usually when they come, they will chit-chat and after a while, they'll start cooking.
Yeah.
So as they cook, I would be with them. And then it was the perfect, it was really nice, because part of it was because when you're with them, you get to hear all the family gossips. then like who is having financial difficulty, who is having an affair and, all that kind of things. Yeah. So I really liked being with her, because I get to hear all these things. Then in the meantime, it's me, I think, learning indirectly what to do and how to do kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask whether, in the past, there was a kind of gender stereotype where, females were meant to be in the kitchen and males were meant to be out of the kitchen? Was there such a thing?
Not in my family. No, there wasn't a thing. It's like what I used to hear when I was young was my grandmother would say things like, "Oh, you should be like your sister, you know, she's always in her room reading her books. Why are you playing all the time? So you come here and you help me." So I'll be like peeling onions, cleaning shallots, cutting things, you know, and she would instruct and teach me how to do things the right way, you know, or her way, so to speak.
Fantastic. But so did you always love being in the kitchen, or did you feel like it was part torture?
No, never a torture. I enjoyed it. I always liked food. Always, I think my sister loved food as well. And it's something very close. I mean, to me, it's food. It's something which is just not what you eat. You know, it's linked to memories. It's linked to tradition. It links to, you know, a lot of things. You know, so it's just not sustenance. It's more than sustenance. And she was, what you call that, and she ran the household. So she did the shopping for food as well. And I think she went to the same market that you went to when you were young at Lakeview, you
Oh
know.
my gosh.
Right. So we moved from Queenstown to Thompson Hills in the early 70s. And when we were at Thompson Hills, it was really very ulu. There weren't Ang Mo Kio was not there. So the only place to do shopping for food was at like Lakeview.
Oh my
So
God.
every Saturday, the whole family would go. It would be like an excursion. My grandmother, my father, and when my mother, when she's around, my mother was a nurse, so she was, you know, she had her duties. But every Saturday we would go to Lakeview early in the morning at 7:30.
I miss that market so much.
Oh, I miss that market so much. And so, and at the hawker center, you know, at the other side, down the steps, kind of thing, you know.
And it was so big, right? The market.
It was huge.
Yeah, compared to like wet markets these days, it was so big.
It was big. I mean, there were two sections, the fruits and I think the fruits, the fish, and then the other side you had the vegetables and the chicken or something like that. You
Yeah,
know,
honestly, I can't remember the wet market side of things. I was like, back then, I was more interested in the eating. So I remember that. I remember that when you walked up the flight of stairs on the right, you have like the bao shop where you can have like steaming baos, and then you have like lor mai kai. And I remember my kindergarten teacher would be sitting there and drinking her kopi before school. And then on the left, it was like the row of hawker stalls, right?
Right. That row of hawker stalls, very fond memories. There was the tau suan, then there was the, it was a tau suan, the chai tau kway, the Hainanese porridge, and then there was a laksa, and the lady always had this beautifully combed bun, you know, kind of thing. And then next to the aisle, then you have the fishball noodle soup, and then you had, right at the end, you had the Hokkien mee, the prawn mee. And it was, you know, we always went to that side and not the other side facing the car park kind of thing. So a lot of fond memories, you know, of that place. And then there was a bookshop around the
It was a
corner facing
bookshop.
the Thompson Road.
Oh my God, I can't remember. I was
I
too
used to
young.
go there to buy my cassettes, you know, my ABBA cassettes, my Bee Gees cassettes, whatever that came out. And that was the place to go. Then it disappeared, you know.
So I mean, like now, when you go back to Singapore, do you feel a sense of like loss? I feel that every time I go back to Singapore, the landscape is changing so rapidly.
It's changing. It's heart-wrenching. That is the word I use. It is heart-wrenching. For me, it's heart-wrenching every time I go back to Singapore, because I see the difference, and it's a significant marked difference every year, and it is really very heart-wrenching. And I try to, what you call it, I try to go to the places which are familiar to me, but even those places are changing rapidly. Although what you call that, certain places they are still very familiar, but I wonder how long they're going to last.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's why a lot of Singaporeans, they have this like unsettled kind of feeling, because I mean, what do you hold on to, you know, when the places that you grew up going to are disappearing at such a
Right.
fast rate?
It is happening at such a fast pace, and it has also become the norm in Singapore. you know, that nothing lasts forever. So for me, it's kind of worrisome because, yeah, it's a sense of ungroundedness, you know, for me. And I think you can relate to it. It's like you're in Australia, I'm in the Netherlands, we are not born in these places. So already it's like, you know, trying to be rooted in a foreign country, there is only so much you can root yourself and so much time to root yourself. And then you go back to your motherland, your home country, and then it's like, huh? I can't even recognize this. Oh, where is my favorite laksa man? Oh, his dad is gone. Oh, where is this? Oh, it's gone. Oh my gosh. Now it's an MRT station, you know. Very small little memories, like the post office at Thompson Road near Sin Lin. It was one of my favorite places to go to, because every time I go back to Singapore, I would post things back to the Netherlands. And then all of a sudden, that whole place disappeared, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, either the Wanam coffee shop near Sin Lin Road, that one, the coffee shop that sells dim sum, that disappeared as well.
At Marymount, is it?
No, it's at it's Upper Thompson Road, the junction of
Thompson Road. Yeah, near the Mee Pok place, right? The Mee Pok, yes. The Prata Hub.
Yes, you know. So even the Mee Pok thing kind of changed, I think, the last time I went back. You know, and everything is changing all the time, you know.
Yeah. And I feel that with COVID, you know, I feel this added sense of urgency to want to go back and taste all the food, you know, before it's gone. Because my favorite hawker stalls are closing, you know, even places that are not like heritage food, places like Waffle Town at Coronation. So I used to go there all the time, you know, for waffles and for like, they had this barbecued fish. And it was actually a scene for Ilo Ilo, which is a Singaporean film. Yeah, yes. And it's gone. Yeah, and it's so
gone. Okay.
It's gone. Yeah, and it's very sad because I feel that it's like, how can you actually like hold on to all these places? You know, there's no way to.
Right. The anchor is not stable. Or it's a dynamic anchor. You know, it's not an anchor that's really anchored. No, yeah. It's always moving. And I guess if I were to be in Singapore, it's fine, because then you're part of the mess and you're just moving with the anchor. Well, everybody is just moving, you know. But we are like this place. Yeah. And we are anchored, like, you know, if you look into the time frame, like a certain time frame, you know, 2 years or a few months, but in between things have changed and we haven't caught up and we were not part of the movement.
Oh, so sad the way you phrase it.
So, I mean, that's the reality. I mean, that's the heart-wrenching part, which I think a lot of Singaporeans cannot relate to.
Unless you live abroad, right? And then you experience that same feeling of
correct. I think Singaporeans, I think they would understand, but they wouldn't understand the psychological meaning of that.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, that's the thing about being abroad. I guess you always see things back home in Singapore with like a different set of lens, like this lens of nostalgia, and everything is like so rose tinted, right?
There's a part of it that is what you call, it's a lot of nostalgia.
Yeah.
And part of it is, you know, whether we want to admit it or not, it is an element of homesickness.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people wouldn't want to say it, but to me, it's homesick, you know. It's like, whether you choose to admit or not, for me, it's like, you know, I'm home here, but I'm also not at home.
Admitting to that feeling of being displaced, lah.
Right. Ungroundedness, lah, you know.
So would you consider like the Netherlands as your home now, or Singapore?
It is my home. I mean, this is where I'm staying. But in some ways, it's like, you know, there will always be a subtle difference.
Yeah.
You know, the fact is, you know, when in my first 30 years of my life, I didn't share it with them here. You know, so I didn't have a Dutch childhood.
Yeah.
I didn't have the same life experience. I didn't grow up here. So in some ways, you know, there is a difference. It's the same. It's like, you know, I for the first 20 years of my life, I was in Singapore. Then I was, you know, then I was in Australia. Then I had a job that which brought me all over the world kind of thing. It's different because once you're away from Singapore for quite some time or from your home country, you are not part of, you have stopped developing together as a whole with the host country. You know, you like it or not, that's what it is, you know.
Yeah.
It's a painful fact, but it's a reality.
So how do you reconcile that?
How do I reconcile it? By admitting that that's the way the cookie crumbles. You can't change anything. In the meantime, it's like I just do things that capture memories of Singapore. So the food that I make, and I try to capture the taste and the texture and the whatever you want to call it of certain points in my life. So the lapis is from the 70s when I was very young. I remember we had a housewarming at one of our relatives in Pasir Ris in the 70s. And she made the lapis, which is like what I'm making now kind of thing. And I remember she used to make the lapis in a charcoal oven.
Ooh.
You know, in a round charcoal oven, and her lapis was round kind of thing. And then much later, I met this old auntie and she made the lapis exactly the same, even better. So I kind of, you know, learned it from her, and she was generous enough to share her recipe with me. And I practiced the last 22 years to get it right.
But that's wonderful. I feel that you should like pass it down to the next generation or something. Like your skills are really amazing.
I promise her I would never share her recipe.
So I think that's the thing.
Unfortunately, it's going to go with me to my grave.
So sad. Oh my God.
No, it's very sad. But the thing is, even if I were to give someone the recipe, he or she would not be able to do it.
Yeah, because it's a lot of experience and skill.
Right. It's a lot of experience, a lot of skills. It's like how I... Because this is what I think. Once you repeat something over and over again, the process will teach you. The whole philosophy of my mother, my grandmother, the Pranakas, they will always say things like agak agak, you know. So a lot of people will say things estimate. It's not estimate. It's cooking intuitively. There's nothing about guessing, you know. Yeah. It's you actually know what to do. So there's nothing. So even with the lapis as well, you know, it's only this year. I kind of all of a sudden it's like, okay, now I can admit to myself I can do it. It's a matter of managing the ingredients. So you have butter, you have eggs. And both of them are living ingredients, you know. They are alive, you know. They're dead, but they're actually alive, you know, kind of thing. So you have to manage the ingredients, and I have to manage the temperature here because it's a cold country here. So it's like, you know, how do I manage the butter? And you know the properties of butter. I mean, it's like, you know, when it's cold, it will solidify kind of thing. How do I manage the temperature so that it would affect the ingredients the way it should affect kind of thing? It's like, it's always cold here kind of thing, you know. And then I have to manage the, what you call that, the oven as well. Because the oven is like, you can say it's constant, but the temperature goes up and down. So,
yeah.
So it's managing different what you call that, things are dimensions in order to bake something well kind of thing, you know.
So do you cook other than baking?
Yes. So basically when I started learning how to cook, I was only interested in making kuehs. So in making nyonya kuehs, so to speak. When I was young, you know, I used to eat very yummy home-cooked kuehs kind of thing, you know. And then when, what you call that, lo and behold, you know, in the 80s, people stopped making home, you know, making kuehs at home because, you know, things became commercially available. So what you used to hear is like, you know, our back things like, hey, auntie, can you make kuih salad for me? You know? They say, aya, don't want lah, you know, I'm old already lah, tired lah. You go and buy from that shop, you know, and you know what shop that is. And I said, but it's different. Then she said, aya, can lah. can la, you know, that was the response. Everybody was like saying, "Aiyah, tak kuasa lah, you know, tired already, old already, have to take care of grandchildren. You go and buy from the shop." Then you say things like, "It's not the same, you know." Yeah la, not the same. Aiyah, but can la, you know. Mm-hmm. For that difference, you know, you want me to cook, you know. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people stop baking. So mm-hmm. I see that in my family as well. My mother used to make pineapple tarts, bang cake, suji cake, kueh blanda for Chinese New Year. She stopped when I went to secondary school in 81. So when 81, she stopped making. And she said, "You can buy from the shops, but."
Mm-hmm.
Then you say, "But it's different." She said, "Aiyah, can la, you know, can la, you know." It's rather than to slave, and you know, people started buying from shops.
Yeah.
From the 80s, I started recording and learning because I realized that no, even my mother, my aunts, or all the people around me, they are not making anymore.
Mm.
So
there was like manual documentation, not like on a blog or something. The blog.
No, it was manual documentation. I still have my dot matrix printed recipes kind of thing. So funny. And I started going around asking, you know, how do you make, how do you make, how do you make, how do you make? I started compiling and I started developing my own recipe based on different people. Mm. So my kueku or my angku kue recipe is a recipe of like 7 people.
Wow.
So I take the best from everybody kind of thing and it came up with something. But it's something where what you call that, a lot of people would take the benchmark of, oh, good angku kue is there. In Singapore, no, there are a few places. People say it's good, but it's never the same as homemade.
Yeah, I agree.
And the real Peranakan kueku, nobody is selling because it's too labor intensive.
I feel that with COVID now, more and more home-based businesses are starting to sell these kind of labor-intensive kueh. So I feel that, you know, in some way, COVID was a good thing for...
It's a good thing, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like, I mean, everyone talks about the downsides of COVID, but I think it actually did a lot for heritage food in Singapore, don't you think?
It did a lot. It really did a lot. If I look into... my case in the Netherlands. So sometimes I do make my things and I offer to Singaporeans living here. And it was because of COVID that I have the time to stay at home and to do all these things, you know.
Mm.
And to me, it's also, for me, it's also one of these things. But one of the things is to, what you call that, to share with Singaporeans here what kuehs are supposed to taste like. You know, it's a little bit OCD and there's a tinge of pride and arrogance. Like, you know, the commercial things are commercial things. Homemade things are homemade things.
No, but, you know, I think that is the huge benefit that your generation has. My generation grew up with, like, all the shop-bought stuff. I never tasted homemade kuehs until I married my husband and his grandma taught me how to make her angku kueh. And I was like, oh, my God, I never loved angku kueh. But after having tasted hers, the skin was so soft. It was so tender. It was, you know, so thin.
All
and
right.
Like the filling she made herself, she would make like the mung bean filling and she would add a little bit of ginger juice to it. And it was amazing. Like, I never loved kueh until I had hers.
Right. So a lot of people think kuehs are too sweet, stodgy, floury, sticky, you know. But real kueh, the texture is very, very different. Mm. And especially if you make them with freshly pressed coconut milk, it is divine, you know. So what I'm making is from Tetra Pak coconut milk. It's already, I tried my best to replicate the taste. But if I were to use freshly grated coconut and I squeeze the santan out of it, the taste is totally different.
Mm. So do you feel that... Do you feel hopeful about Singaporean cuisine? I mean, it feels like a very like solo man effort on your part, right? Like trying to relive all of these memories. But, you know, a lot of young Singaporeans in Singapore, they would never think of making their own kueh, let alone squeezing their own coconut milk.
I think in the end, it wouldn't be a what you call that, a mass thing. It would be a specialized thing. So you would have crazy people like me who would want to do these things, you know. Will it?
But I guess like the number of people who actually know how to make these things and people who have actually tasted the real thing, the group size would be so small, you
very
know.
Very small. The thing is, even my generation, not everybody had the good fortune to taste them.
Mm.
And you're talking about people having their childhood in the 70s.
Mm.
So in some ways, you know, I was lucky to be able to watch. It's the tail end of the era where you have people who cook their food every day. It's a tail end of the era where you had the old ladies who knew everything, you know, in their heads kind of thing. So even when it came to my mother's generation, she was a working mom. Mm. She didn't spend her time cooking. She didn't spend her time cooking every day. My grandmother did all the cooking. She didn't learn cooking when she was young.
Mm.
She learned cooking from Tam Yu Gai. You know, and that she was that generation in the 60s where they would learn from Tam Yu Kai and blah, blah, blah. And then I think at that era was also, you know, wanting to learn different things kind of thing, and your own culture and all those things is just put aside kind of thing, you know. It very much showed in contemporary Singapore where people would want to cook pasta, make French food and, you know, foie gras and God knows what. But their own things, who is really interested in making the real traditional heritage foods? It's always seen as something that is, hate to say it, second class.
Mm.
You know, very sad, you know, where our own things, our own food, our own culture is always put at a second place where and everyone is chasing towards, you know, the latest and blah and sushi and God knows what and all kinds of things.
But know? I feel that we are seeing a new a new era, you know, with you know, in the past few years. So I remember that when I was a young cook, you know, there was no interest in heritage food, right? It's seen as super uncool to want to make like zicha at home, like replicate some zicha food at home, or even to make like the food that your mother or your grandmother made, you know. So when I was a young cook, I was always chasing after European produce, European dishes, wanted to make like souffles, you know. I never even thought of making kueh. But I think partly it was because, like what you said, the older generation have this like exacting standards because they grew up with that kind of quality kueh or quality local dishes that I felt that whatever I made would never match up, you know. Anything that I make that is local would be met with like scathing remarks or like criticism, you know, like, yeah, it's not good, you know what I mean? Because the older generation, they don't mince their words. And so like, you know, I'm very sensitive. So I really would hate that kind of comment. So I started cooking a lot of Western food. And I feel that it was only after I moved abroad that I really discovered how important it is to cook local food and to embrace your Singaporeanness, you know. But I'm just afraid that, what if a Singaporean living in Singapore has never had an opportunity to live abroad like us and never experienced how precious it is to have the culinary heritage that we do, you know? Then what is that impetus to want to reconnect with their heritage?
It's very tricky. The thing is, you only appreciate it when you lose it.
That's which is too late, right?
I mean, it's the same with us, you know? Mm. We start really appreciating when we are out of the country. Mm.
Yeah.
When you're in there, you always take things for granted. And that's the human psyche, you know.
Yeah.
It's wired in our DNA and in every single human being. It's only when you start losing things that you start appreciating things.
Yeah. And I guess like that is the biggest challenge that I have running Singapore Noodles. I mean, my mission is to get more young Singaporeans living in Singapore to be interested in home cooking and like cooking Singaporean food at home. But, you know, how can I bring that kind of awareness of the importance to them, you know? That is what I am still trying to figure out.
I think it's manifested in food, but it's, if you were to go deeper, then it's more than food. It's also the environment.
Mm.
You know, the Singaporean environment, it's very different. Certain things are normalized. And it's also, in Singapore, food is so convenient and so cheap. So there isn't also an impetus to cook yourself, you know.
Yeah. Unless it is for reasons like health, right? Like where you want to eat healthy.
Correct. And then if you look into it, in the modern way of living, it's like not everything needs to be fast and convenient. So it's like, and also the working environment in Singapore, people are so overworked and so tired.
Feel that in the past people used to be, you know, used to work a lot as well?
Yes, but in the past we didn't have iPhones.
I was listening to an interview with Edmund, who is the CEO of Epigram Bookstore in Singapore. And he was saying that, you know, now we keep complaining that people have iPhones and technology. But back then, people were also distracted by things like kite flying and like fighting spiders. Okay.
Video watching, watching videos, Hong Kong series. I remember in the 80s, you would have aunties and what who refuse to make quiz because they want to watch don't know how many video cassettes or God knows what.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, of course. But I guess it's the intensity that's different. That's the difference. And also, you know, don't know. I think it's a very tricky thing. I really don't know what it is. So what I am doing is I am just putting things out there. With the attitude, I don't care. I just put down there. You want to see, you see. You don't want to see, that's your problem. It's like, I'll just share whatever I share. It's a glimpse into what I'm doing. So on Instagram, it's really mundane things. You know, my mother would always say things like, why are you always making nasi lemak? Why are you always making sayur lodeh? I was saying things like, yeah, because I want to make the best nasi lemak. I want to make the best sayur lodeh. I want to make the best lapis. And that's it, you know. So I'm always repeating the same thing, you know. You repeat, 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 repeat until it becomes part of your nature, you know. In our contemporary, what you call that, world now, it's like, you know, everybody wants to do it once and be a master of a recipe. But that doesn't happen. My old auntie used to tell me things like, you know, I'll say, hey, auntie, recipe, you know, no good, you know. You know what she would say? No, not my recipe, no good. You no good.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like you need to have developed the skills. One would need to develop skills. One would need to develop the intuition, you know. And that unfortunately takes time.
In a way, it's very Japanese, right? That kind of mindset.
Yeah, it is very Japanese. So if you look into it, it's like, you know, the sashimi chef that would spend 5 years cutting fish. Yeah. Before he could, you know, go on to the next level. It's that.
You know, how many young Singaporeans will have that kind of mindset? Because it's a very, like, older generation kind of mindset, right? Where you put in the hard work. It's like what they call kung fu, right? Like, you really have to practice.
It is kung fu. It is. So when I was young, when I was learning kuis or learning all these things, can relate to what you say, lah, you know, the you have to understand that the older generation, they operate in a very different way, you know. When they encourage you, they encourage you by putting you down, you know. So, but we are brought up in a very different way, you know. I think open to like positive affirmations and blah, 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 and all those things. But to them, they're totally alien concept to them. It's like, no, you shouldn't say good things. No, remember in the past, the older generations will never say that a baby is beautiful and good.
Oh my God.
Say, oh, such an ugly baby. Oh, horrible. And blah, blah, blah. And that. You know, that was the culture then.
Exactly.
You're not supposed to praise, you know.
I feel that is one of the reasons why, like, I feel like my mental health has improved dramatically since leaving Singapore. Don't you think so? I feel like... Like, I remember when I was having lunch with an Australian and a Japanese friend, and I was telling them about my, you know, my childhood, how my parents would correct me and things like that. And or like how, you know, my relatives would say certain things. And like, my Australian friend was like so shocked, you know, he was like, he turned to his Japanese partner and he was like, did you get the same thing? You know, and he was so concerned. And I was like, you know, it's so interesting that, you know, in Singapore, what is normalized could be seen as toxic or even abusive in Western cultures.
But I think it's what you call it, it's, of course, when you see things with that those glasses, but you need to put things in context. And a lot of things are seen out of context, you know. So, like, when I was growing up, you know, when, you know, learning from aunties and learning, you know, they would say things like, why are you so stupid?
Yeah.
You know, the word stupid, foolish, it's used very, very liberally and easily.
Yeah.
You know? But it's actually, what you call that, it's actually a term of endearment.
It is. But I mean, as a child, instinctively, would you feel like, oh, I feel terrible because, you know, this word is used on me. Have you ever felt that way?
No.
I always was so affected, you know, like by such kind of things. I really hated it.
I don't know. I think I've got to wait another 20 years and see psychologically what will manifest. I don't know. Yeah, yeah. But then it's like being silly, being blah, it's like, don't know, lah, you just laugh it off, lah, you know. It's like, no, like cooking kind of thing. It's like, you know, so silly, you should be doing this. So silly, you should be doing that. Why you're so stupid, you know, kind of thing.
I feel like that is one of the reasons why a lot of the younger Singaporeans that I know, they shun cooking Singaporean food for that reason. Because they can't stand their mothers or their grandmothers nagging at them. Like, it's literally like another mental or like physical obstacle in their way, you know, in the kitchen. And so, like, sometimes when I talk to my friends, they'll tell me, Pam, you know, just wait until I get my own house and then I will start cooking Singaporean food. Because it's almost impossible when the kitchen is seen as like a territory of like the matriarch of the family, right?
Psychologically speaking, yes, because you're talking about power and control.
The psychology background is showing.
Right. Psychologically, yes, because it's all about power and power, status, control. It's, you know, and it's in the human DNA that, you know, one would want to dominate the other kind of thing, you know. But it's one of those things where, you know, I guess in some way I managed to negotiate. So to me, then what I want to eat was more important than all these things.
Yeah, tam jiak la.
Tam jiak la. You know, very, 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 very much, very greedy. Wanted to eat the best thing, wanted to learn, you know. And I do understand it was very frustrating. So it's like, you go to an old auntie and say, auntie, you teach me how to make kueh salad. Yeah, yeah, I'll teach you. Come. So when you're there, she's already cooking already. It's like, what is there to teach?
Yeah.
You know? Because to me, it's like, you say you want to teach me, and then when I'm there, you're already making it, you're stirring the kaya already. It's like, but before that, how did you put that? And, you know? Yeah. And then the common answer is, Like that lah, you know. Like that lah. And then how much sugar do you use? Agak lah. You know, if your eggs is like that, then about equal lah. And then can a little bit less. But auntie, if I put a little bit less, would it affect? Sometimes lah. And then after you adjust lah. It's like, huh? You know. So it was the same thing my grandmother was making, there was one she was, no, I was making kueh lapis, the steam kueh lapis, the Cantonese would say the gao cheng gou kind of thing. So I followed a cookbook, you know, the recipe of a cookbook. And then it failed, you know, and it just wouldn't gel, it wouldn't form. My grandmother, yeah, you're so stupid. And then she just took over everything, and then she took her hot the santan that was boiling, and she just took it and she just poured it into a flour. I said, no, what are you doing? It's not according to the recipe and blah, blah. And then she just said things, something like, this is the way it's done. What you read, I know how to make. Why don't you come to me? Why you are so stupid? Kind of look, go and read a recipe book. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, but
so they know a lot of things, but they were not very encouraging.
Yeah, but at the same time, I always feel that like grandmothers or mothers always think that they know best just because they are older. You know what I mean? And then when you question like, oh, why do you do it like that? They can't give you a response. They'll be like, that's the way I saw my mom do it, you know? And you're like, huh? So you just blindly follow, and then they'll be like, yeah, just follow, you know? So things like, you know, old wives' tales, like stirring your dumpling mixture in a single direction with your chopsticks, or like, you know, putting a soup spoon in a pot of braising, you know, maybe pork belly or something to make it even more tender. You really can't discern what is true and what is not. And like, if you dare to say anything, you know, they will just get so upset.
Because I think they're not trained in that way. They're not trained to do things scientifically.
Mm.
So there isn't a scientific method.
True.
So in my cooking, I try to adopt a scientific method as well. I think to describe it accurately, it would be an intuitive scientific method. So it's scientific in the sense that I want to replicate things, but because ingredients are something which are not there and constant, so you need to be intuitive as well. So it's different skills which a person would need to develop, you know.
Yeah. And now when you cook, where do you get your ingredients from? I mean, I'm surprised that you can find all the ingredients in the Netherlands.
Yeah, you can, because there is a colonial past. There's the Dutch colonized Indonesia, so there are a lot of Indonesians here. So you can get a lot of the things for the rempah here, no problem. Even easier now than 20 years ago.
Mm.
And then I've got my friends and my mother. They always send packages of food, you know.
Yeah.
So I last got 4 big packets of ikan bilis, 2 packets of hebi. My friend sent me 120 buakaluak nuts.
Oh my god!
It's a different language, different language of love, you know. That's how they communicate, you know. It's the Asian way, you know.
Yeah, true. Food is love,
Food is love because it is. You know what it is? It is people fail to realize, because food, it is effort. So it is not saying I love you. Very easy, you know, I love you. You say 3 words, I love you. But to cook food for someone and as expression of love, it is effort, you know.
Yeah.
And it is a lot. So it is not only cooking. It is shopping for the food.
Yeah.
It is cleaning up after that.
Yeah. But actually, right, I feel that it depends on your, what do they call it? Love language, you know?
Yes, precisely.
Because like, for example, for me, my acts of service is very low, you know? The highest one is probably words of affirmation. Yeah, which is why I probably get so sensitive about, you know, criticism, or like, you know, I feel that Asian people should be more expressive, you know, with their children especially, because I feel that it's so different from Western culture, in that in Asian culture you have the hierarchy, right? Like there is this element of respect in addition to love. But here it's like, in Australia, at least with my friends, it's all like, oh, I want to be your best friend as your parent kind of thing, which is not that common in Asia. So I feel that after having moved to Australia, it really highlighted some of the differences that I experience and I see in Singapore, and I feel that there is a growing gap, you know, at least, like some people would say that it's a disdain for the older generation, for the way that they parent, the way that they operate. Like, for example, with my mom, right, she's very, like, she doesn't say what she thinks. So for example, when she... when we bring her to a restaurant, say I bring her to an Australian restaurant, she would just like pick at the food, and I'll be left wondering, like, is she hungry? Is she not hungry? Does she like the food? Does she not like the food? Is the food too expensive? That's why she's not eating? Or is it like the portion is too small? And then so I'll bring her to like an Asian restaurant where it's like big plate, you know, lots of value, and she'll tuck in, and I'm like, oh, okay, so that's the thing. You know what I mean? But it's a lot of guesswork. And I was watching The Joy Luck Club. I'm not sure if you watched that movie, but I was like, oh my god, that scene. of the cook always have to, you know, criticize her own cooking, saying, oh, you know, this is not a very good piece of steamed fish. And then like the literal, yeah, Western interpretation is to, you know, add more seasoning, right? I was like, oh my God, like I can totally relate to that.
It's a different way of communication. It's cultural, you know, and you need to be in the culture to understand. You know?
Yeah, correct. And I mean, you living abroad, you know, how do you reconcile these new notions of expressing love and like the symbolism of food compared to like in the Asian culture which you were brought up in?
Can't even try lah, you know. Don't even want to try, so to speak. Because you're talking about a different set of values. Different set of values, different set of priorities. It's a totally different culture. I would be able to watch Chokoda, I would be able to try and let people understand the symbolism, the language behind certain things. But I guess a lot of people here wouldn't be able to get it. So like, for example, in the Netherlands, there's an unwritten rule that everything needs to be prepared in 20 minutes. Like dinner needs to be prepared in 20 minutes. If it's more than 20 minutes, you're spending too much time cooking.
Really? Oh, that's shocking.
Because you know why? Because a typical Dutch dinner is aardappelgroentevlees, which means potatoes, vegetables, meat. Potatoes are usually peeled and boiled. How long does it take to cook potatoes? 20 minutes. In the meantime, you boil your vegetables and you fry your meat in butter. Mm-hmm. So everything needs to be done in 20 minutes. And for me, it's not even enough time for the preparation and the mise en place. It's not even enough time to do that. It's like, 20 minutes, what can you eat?
Oh my gosh, I never knew.
Yeah, so that's the mentality of the people here. So when I first came here, you know, then watch where I would be cooking, you know, mee siam, and spend the whole day cooking. And people are like, wow, so much effort, blah, and all these things. And to me, it's like, normal, what? Wait till you see what we do for Christmas. We spend 3 days cooking, and everything is done in half an hour.
What do you make for Christmas?
Oh, on Christmas in Singapore, we used to make Peranakan food.
Oh, okay.
You know, so it takes 3 days. No, the first day you do all your rempah, everything. The second day you do your meat and blah, whatever you can prepare beforehand. And the third day you cook.
So you're saying that the Dutch are people that eat to live. Is that it? Like food is...
I think traditionally. Things have changed a lot. When I first came here in the late 90s and now. And now it's becoming like Singapore, like people chasing about, you know, what's in places and, you know, all kinds of things. Mm. But what you call that, it's moving, like, you know, a lot of things are like trends now, kind of thing.
Mm. I think for me, like the biggest difference that I discern between Singaporeans and Australians is that maybe it's because I'm living rurally, so the difference is even more stark. But I felt that like, in Singapore, the diversity that we have, we take for granted. Like, I always assumed that everyone was as adventurous when it came to eating or had as diverse a palate growing up. But I realized that that's not the case because now when I live in the countryside, right, like, people usually just go to the pub and eat, like, fish and chips or chicken schnitzel, that kind of stuff. And I was like, wow, like, you know, are you never sick of that? You know what I mean?
I think people will never be sick of it because what you don't know, you won't miss.
Yeah, true.
You know, so it's a totally different psyche that we are talking about, you know.
Mm, yeah. So I prepare Wex's lunchbox. And fun fact, he works for a Dutch company.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, like his colleagues, right, they will always be looking at his lunchbox and they will always be eating instant things like instant... I don't know what they eat, like instant food. And then they'll look over at his lunchbox and every single day is like a different cuisine. Because like his lunchbox is usually what we have for dinner, but leftovers, right? So it goes into the lunchbox. You'll be like, huh? Your wife knows how to make like cornbread and she knows how to make like Chinese food, and she knows how to make like Yorkshire puddings for Christmas. Like, you know, they just can't grapple with it.
Of course, well, you know, I mean, it's normal. I mean, to us, it's very normal, you know, kind of thing. And I think what you call it, and sometimes, you know, for me, it's like, you know, when friends come over, it's like, oh, cannot cook Asian, really. Otherwise, they think that I can only cook Asian thing, you know. No. Mm-hmm. So I'll cook my French stews and all these things, and they're like, oh, ah, so nice. So of course, not very OCD, but I do things the right way.
Yeah, wow.
So it's as you say, lah, you know, it's like, I think we Singaporeans, in some ways, we are exposed. I think at a young age, we are really exposed to different things, you know, the Malay, Indians, Chinese, and within the Chinese, you've got, you know, all kinds of Hokkien food, Cantonese food, Teochew food, Hakka food, God knows what. Then you've got Peranakan food. Then you've got Malay food. You've got different kinds of Malay foods, different kinds of Indian food. And already that's a lot. Then you throw in the things of, you've got Thai food, Vietnamese food, Japanese food, Korean food. Then you have Italian, French, God knows what, pub food, English food, colonial food. It's like, it's, you know, even what we ate at home in the past, you know, it's all kinds of things, you know. It's like my mum and my grandmother would cook all kinds of things. So it's never like, you know, if you're Hokkien, you eat only Hokkien things.
Yeah, definitely.
Cantonese, you only eat Cantonese things. So we had Cantonese soups.
Yeah.
You know.
It's very interesting because like today I made chicken with glutinous rice wine soup, and I always thought of it as like a Hakka dish, you know. Mm-hmm. But then I was talking to my mom about it, and she was like, you know, your papa also make it too, and like my papa is Cantonese, right? And then when I was like posting about my process online, this Peranakan lady was like, oh my god, my mom makes it exactly the same way as you do. And I was like, huh, so Peranakans make it too, you know. I was like so amazed that I thought this dish was very culture specific, but it turned out that everyone embraces it in Singapore.
So like what you mentioned, you know, like what's his name? Matt Lloyd Tan, is it?
Matthew
Lloyd Tan. No, it has daily Nonya
dishes.
Quite a significant number of things we eat at home as well, you know. So to me, it's like, yes, you can say it's Nonya, but there are no hard and fast lines, so to speak, you know.
I love that.
There were a lot of overlap kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of being in Singapore. It's like, you know, like that kind of shared nature of food.
My grandmother used to make dumplings, you know, bak chang. And she uses the feng rempa in the bak chang.
And the pork as well?
The pork.
She does so, like... imagine. Does she braise or does she chop into small pieces like the nonya chang?
So it's the same like nonya chang, you know, chop everything into tiny pieces.
Oh,
and then the rempa, so most people, they'll just use ketumbar, no coriander.
Yeah.
But her rempa is coriander, jintan putih, and jintan manis. It's exactly the same as the feng rempa.
I just wrote down on a piece of paper, feng dumplings. So I'm going to make them.
And it's so yummy.
As far as
I know, she was the only one who made it.
And the rice, she wouldn't spice it or anything?
It's not spiced.
Okay. And no blue pea, no nothing?
No blue pea, nothing.
No. Okay, I'm going to make that the
it's really yummy because 2 years ago, I had this bulk of homesickness. So I made just the filling, you know, and I ate it with rice. I was like,
Shucks, yeah.
That kind of thing. I said, oh, I feel at home already, kind of, you know.
Yeah. So are you gonna go back to Singapore? I mean, now that is there VTL for Netherlands?
We had a VTL, then it disappeared because of Omicron.
Okay. So how long have you not been back? 3 years, 2 years?
The last time I was in Singapore was Chinese New Year 2020. It would be good to go back, like, you know.
Yeah, but yeah.
Given the circumstances, it's like, you know, I've kind of adjusted my expectations as well, like, you know.
Yeah, I'm going back in April. Hopefully, like, you know, that's still a possibility, like, because I'm so homesick. You know, today when I made the chicken with glutinous rice wine soup, seriously, when I ate it, like, the moment it entered my mouth, suddenly I started like tearing up, and like that was the first time ever that I had cried while eating, like literally crying into the bowl of soup. And I was like, what is happening? You know what I mean? It's like that cliche, right? The ratatouille moment where
Right. It's the Madeleine moment. It comes with age.
Oh, don't say that.
And be happy about it, because it is a pure human. Yeah, you're just being human, you know. Just celebrate the fact, you know. Those moments are to be cherished. Those are actually moments of blessings. Very, very special moments.
Yeah, definitely. I was like, oh my god, you wouldn't think that, you know what I mean? It's such a simple dish, you know, with like 5 ingredients. And I always feel that the simplest dishes are the ones that are the most profound. You know, they are the ones that really touch you in such a deep way.
I'm very happy you say that, because that is what I share as well. It's if you can't enjoy simple food, then it becomes a big question mark. And I think a lot of people are chasing over complex food, you know, God knows what, expensive things, blah, blah, blah. But to me, it's like, no, if you can appreciate very simple food, then it's really, then you're really in touch with your soul. You know, simple food is like a fried egg, rice, and oh, you know what I really like? My grandmother used to make that. Oh, it is so yummy. It is so yummy. But probably I'll have a heart attack or a stroke. She used to cook food with lard, you know, so she'll render her own lard. Then she'll save the crackling, you know, they call it the bak yu po, the jiyong za kind of thing. Have you heard of this dish, the Peranakans called sambal hebi?
Hebi hiam.
Hebi hiam, yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So imagine hebi hiam but made with pork crackling. So she used to make that. Yummy.
So you mean she would fold the crackling into the...
She would have a hebi hiam, she'll fold the crackling into that.
Oh my gosh.
And you eat it with just rice, cucumber, and a fried egg, and it's so yummy.
Oh my god, I have to try that. I really...
It is so yummy. It is so yummy.
I need to have that in my life, seriously. I'm writing all of these things down.
It is so yummy. Another thing she had was, she would fry ikan bilis, and then when it's done, she would pour away most of the oil away. She'll put sugar, and she'll put tau yu inside. And the whole thing will be caramelized, you know. The sugar will melt, and it will coat the ikan bilis, and then she'll put dark soy sauce, and it will coat. So you have this salty, sweet, caramelized ikan bilis, and we eat that with rice.
Oh, I think I had something similar when I was working at Candle Nut. They used to make this ikan bilis sambal.
Okay.
And it was very similar. It was like this really black thing. Yeah. Right. Probably like, you know, variations of the same dish.
It's home food, you know.
Yeah.
It's really home food. It's nothing fantastic. Self in Canada can put a star there.
Yeah.
You know, but it's all home food. Like my mother used to say things, oh, yeah, all these things are home food lah, you know. Nothing fantastic lah. You put in a Michelin star restaurant, you put a star down there, but it's also home food.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I feel that is what's so unique about Singaporean food, is that home cooking, like the food that we eat at home, is so spectacular. Like whether it is the simple dishes or like the laborious festival kind of dishes, like the amount of thought that goes into it is like spellbounding. Like my mom was teaching me how to make the chicken with glutinous rice swine soup. She was teaching me like all sorts of tricks, like how to clean the chicken. So instead of blanching it, you can rub it with flour and salt, and then like rinse it with water, and that gets rid of all the blood and impurities, and it creates like this really like clean tasting soup. It's like even simple dishes like that have so much wisdom, and I really love that part about Singaporean cooking. It's so artisanal.
there is a lot of effort. So if you look into it, there is a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. So talking about cleaning chicken, the first time I cleaned a chicken in the Netherlands, my partner was like, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm cleaning a chicken. Ah." I said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Dirty, why? Dirty." He said, "No, you can just use." I said, "No, you cannot just buy from a supermarket and just broke it into your, no, it's dirty, you have to clean it." So I had a whole chicken, so I was cleaning the inside or cleaning the outside kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then I said, "You see how dirty it is?" And a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
So they think that things are ready to cook, you know, but no, I said, "No, you have to clean it, it's very dirty." Then he realized that, oh, you know, whatever you want, the taste is clean.
Well, he can tell the difference.
He could tell the difference. He said, "Oh, it's different." He said, "Yeah, of course, you have to clean it. Dirty, what I told you."
Mm.
You know, so these things, when I grew up, I saw my grandmother and my mother doing them. You know, they would clean, they would blah. And it's like a lot of work before you can cook, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of effort. Mm.
But it's so worth it, lah. I feel that, you know. I feel that home cooking is really an expression of love. It's like how much care you put into the food reflects the amount of love that you have for your family. And I think that is something that I wish more young Singaporeans really knew.
We will get there, you know.
Mm.
No, whatever it is, we will get to where we will get to kind of thing. It's actually beyond our control.
Mm.
So I think you are doing your thing.
And you are doing those as well with your blog.
I'm doing my thing. I mean, to me, I'm just doing my thing. I wonder, I think not many people subscribe to the way I cook and my philosophy, so to speak. And for me, it's like, so be it, lah. You know, it's like, I just do my thing. If it's received, it's received. If it's not received, it's not received, lah. So it's like St. John the Baptist in the desert screaming and screaming and shouting and shouting. And it's like, you want to hear, you hear, lor. You don't want to hear, never mind, lor. You know, I just continue baking my lapis kind of thing. You want to eat, you eat. You don't want to eat, you don't eat. It's like, it's an invitation. And it's like, if people are interested, then here I am. You know, I'm here. Get as much information from me when I am still alive, so to speak.
Yes, I feel like people like you are like national treasures. So much information, so much stories, so much knowledge and know-how. Anyway, this has been such a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Likewise.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You have been listening to Christopher Ng of the blog Christopher's Asian Delicacies. We now stand at the crossroads where we are witnessing the vanishing of traditional dishes and the gradual erosion of our rich food culture. Now, more than ever, we have to encourage one another to get back into the kitchen to cook food from our heritage. Singapore Noodles is offering a membership dedicated to equipping anyone with everything that they need to start cooking local. Visit sgpnoodles.com to find out more. Once again, thank you for listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we believe in a world where Singaporeans are proud of our rich and diverse food culture and play an active role in keeping traditions alive.